Well, pray for me tonight. My voice is wearing out, and so I'll be taking some pauses along the way here. If you ever hear Baptist mentioned in secular textbooks, it's usually in terms of our impact upon history, in terms of religious liberty and things like that. But I think a more important impact is on the modern missionary movement. The 19th century is usually recognized by missiologists as the great century of missions. During that century, for the first time, Christianity became a genuinely worldwide religion. It was planted in every continent at the cost of thousands of lives with immeasurable impact, especially, for example, a few years ago, Africa actually celebrated the impact of missionaries upon their continent's history. Every major country there who has a ruler, that ruler was educated in missionary-supported schools, so that they recognize the impact there. That movement has not been sufficiently studied by historians for its impact on history, and the beginning of that movement is usually seen as 1792 and a man named William Carey. And that man was, in fact, a Baptist. I want to talk about William Carey, his life and contribution to Baptist history and to the world. He was an Anglican raised in England. In the late 18th century, 1761 was his date of birth. Raised Anglican, but at the age of 14, he heard a Baptist preacher and was converted. Now, he waited 7 years to get baptized. I'm not sure if it was because of family pressure, but in that day, quite often, they thought baptism was an adult decision anyway. So he waited till he was 21 to be baptized and then began to preach. And by all accounts, at first, very poorly. He was a dynamic, spellbinding preacher, but he began to have a very deep concern for those who were in other areas. This was the era in England when Captain Cook had been making those voyages to the South Pacific. The reports were coming back of these exotic places with strange customs and people like that. Well, Carey began to study the situation around the world. He wrote a book eventually where he talked about all the means in this country and this country, this country, and the religion, Mohammedan, his name for Islam, Hindu, or something pagan. And he was fascinated by all these places and that had no gospel witness. He was even for a while a cobbler making shoes. He took scraps of leather and made a model of the globe. In all these years where there was no Christian preaching, he began to be more and more concerned about that and began asking the local pastors around him about, is it possible that the last verses of Matthew's gospel, those verses we call the Great Commission, I've been trying to find when they were first called the Great Commission. It wasn't in Carey's day, I think it was 20th century, but are they applicable to Christians today? Now, the typical interpretation in the Reformation and after was those verses were addressed to the apostles. They were supposed to go out and make disciples of all nations, but they didn't think about them being applicable to people today. And so Carey began to ask, could this be the situation? And one of the obstacles he met, we talked about last week, hyper-Calvinism. One minister spoke to comment this to Carey. He said, Carey, sit down, young man. When God wants to convert the heathen, he will do it without consulting you or me. Yeah? And so not a great deal of compassion, concern there. Well, Carey began to think about that. His response is one of the landmark books in missiology and indeed in the history of Christianity. It was called An Inquiry into the Obligation of Christians to Use Means for the Conversion of the Heathen. Now, that's the partial title. In those days, titles went three or four lines, and so that's the short title. But this was his idea that we are obligated to use means, we'll talk about the means in a second, for the conversion of the heathen. And he began this with those verses in Matthew 28 that we know very well as the Great Commission. He said, well, as surely as God wants us to teach others and baptize others, he wants us to make disciples of all nations. If we think those commands of baptizing and teaching are obligatory on us, so the command to do it in all nations. And not restricted to the apostles. Again, indeed, if Christ commands us to teach folks to obey everything he commanded, it would include that last command. So it should be passed down to every generation. And so he began to write that book and said, this is our obligation. But his most important importance was the idea we must use different means. the obligation to use means for the conversion. Not just pray about it, not just wish it would happen, but actually to do something. And the means that Carey proposed was the formation of a society. Now, society versus convention, we'll leave that to a little bit later. There's different ideas there that were important. Well, Carey initially proposed a society, and we'll see why in a second. Well, he began to publicize this idea. The book came out. He preached at the local association meeting in May 1792, and by all accounts, this was his best sermon. Expect great things from God. Attempt great things for God. It's kind of the catchword of that sermon. Apparently, a very powerful, passionate sermon. And yet, the meeting was about to close. Carey had preached, we've got to do something. And they said, thank you very much, Mr. Carey. Fine sermon. Shall we close? And he said to Andrew Fuller, who was praying, is nothing to be done? Is nothing again to be done? Yeah. We can't just talk about this. We can't just think. We've got to do something. Finally, almost reluctantly, they adopted a resolution to proceed with plans to form a society for the propagation of the gospel among the heathen. Well, they must have been Baptists, because it took from May to October to get things done. But finally, October the 2nd, 1792, 14 people gathered and met in for the particular Baptist Society for the propagation of the gospel among the heathen. It later changed to the Baptist Missionary Society, which is still operating today. Indeed, some of their missionaries were serving with me in Brazil. It was a society sponsored by all the interested individuals rather than a convention composed of churches. Carey wanted the whole association to support it, but he recognized not everyone was on board. He was sensed with a sense of urgency, and so rather than wait for conditions to ripen, he said, well, I will just go with whoever's ready to go with it. And if those who are interested, and they can begin to sponsor it. And so they formed it. Andrew Fuller was the first president. Again, we mentioned him last week. He gave excellent leadership for the first 22 years. And so finally, they formed the society and began to gather funds together. And on January the 9th, 1793, they met to choose their first missionaries. Well, Carey was obviously a choice, along with a doctor named John Thomas. He had recently served with the British Army in India and came back with a report of the opportunities and needs there, a very glowing account of what was there. Andrew Fuller later wrote this recollection of the meeting. We saw there was a gold mine in India, but it seemed almost as deep as the center of the earth. Who will venture to explore it? I will go down, said Mr. Carey to his brethren, but remember that you must hold the ropes. And the phrase, holding the ropes, to this day, describes the partnership between local churches and mission. They go down into mines, okay, to mine the human treasure there. But we hold the ropes that sustain them, that support them. Well, they appointed Dr. Thomas and William Carey. Now, William Carey, as I mentioned, was very urgent to go. He had a wife and several children. And he was planning to go with himself and his oldest child because his wife had never been 5 miles from her birthplace. And the idea of going across the sea was not very appealing to her. So he was on board with his oldest son about to go for what could be the rest of his life. Yeah, not easy travel back and forth. Well, the captain of the boat decided to wait one more day for a better time. Carey rushed off the ship and back to his house, pleaded with his wife one last time. Will you go with me? Well, finally she gave in, gathered the rest of the family, what they could pack with them in a very rushed time. And she went to the ship, tears in her eyes, terrified of going. But she went, and they got to India. And one of their children died there, which was very common among early missionaries. Carey's wife went into a deep depression, was mentally ill, and was that way the last 13 years of her life. Had to be someone with her all the time, a great grief to Carey. And missions in those days was exceedingly hard, especially on wives. Carey outlived a second wife and was married a third time before he died himself in 1831. Even to this day, in many parts of the world, missions is a more difficult task for the wives than for their husbands. Imagine being a wife in a Muslim society. Your life is very limited there. I had some missionaries that were friends of mine in Pakistan. The wife said, I'm looking forward to coming home on furlough so I can walk beside my husband. In Pakistan, I walk four paces behind him to show my respect. Well, a lot of societies are still very patriarchal, very macho. And so in Kira's day, wives were in a bad way in their husband, especially in India. One custom they had that Kira opposed, when a man died, his widow was often burned on his funeral pyre so she wouldn't be a burden to society. Yeah. Well, Kira opposed that, began to get that story. Well, this was his life, his influence. Well, he didn't make an immediate splash in India. To his surprise, those sitting in darkness were very satisfied sitting in darkness. There was not a flock. We often preach missionary sermons about those waiting in the darkness. Well, they loved darkness. Jesus said, men love darkness rather than light. Their deeds are evil. And so there was not an immediate response to Kira. It was about 6 or 7 years before he won his first convert. It was in a very large church there. His more important contribution was the Indian Bible. Kira was a gifted linguist. He had taught himself about 6 or 8 languages before he left England. Just had one of those minds for languages. And so he began to listen and learn the languages there. And to this day, and Kira's translation is the basis for most Indian translations of the Bible. But even beyond that, most important contribution was this idea that we were obligated to use means for the conversion of the heathen. The Great Commission is still applicable. And this idea of forming a society that would have as its objective sending out people to win the heathen, that caught on. In his own day, the Anglicans, the Congregationalists, all the other soon followed his example in England. And to this day, the model of a society, the idea of getting those who are interested, those who will support an individual, that's the pattern that most modern parachurch organizations and many mission organizations form, the idea of having those with a single purpose, a single focus, you support that person, that's the plan in most societies around the world today. Well, this is what Kira bequeathed to the world. Now, if you want to go further on this, there's a number of great books on missions. My favorite is by a woman, Ruth Tucker. It's called From Irianjaya to Jerusalem. It's 99 mini-biographies. She takes 99 individuals and gives about like a 3 or 4 page snapshot of their life and impact upon missions. Or another book, Timothy George has a biography of Kira that includes within it a full copy of Kira's own work. That landmark work about the obligation to use means for the conversion of the heathen. Well, this is Kira being the father of the modern missionary movement. Well, with that, we'll kind of say farewell to English Baptists and jump the pond. It's been the reference time on developments in America. Now, again, missions among Baptists in America began with Congregationalists. We mentioned that congregational connection last week. Well, again, what happened in the early 19th century, as Kira was over in India, letters came back describing what was going on, and it caught the imagination of Christians around the world. In North America, there was a prayer meeting going on in some college campuses in 1800. This was the beginning of the Second Great Awakening. In New England, it was in the college campuses, in the frontier, that those tent meetings. Well, in Williams College in New England, a group of students were meeting there, thinking about Kira, what he was doing, things like that. Began to have prayer meetings, things like that. And they had had one, and were walking back, a group of students. They got caught in a downpour. Well, they took refuge under a haystack and had a second meeting there. And the haystack prayer meeting is a launching point for missions among North Americans. Because as they prayed, they begin to be convicted. We can do this. We can follow Carrie's lead. We can be involved in winning lost people to Christ. And those folks who were there under the haystack were congregationalists. Sam Mills, Adoniram Judson, Ann Judson, Luther Rice, about four or five others, they went to their denomination, the Congregationalist, and said, we need to form a society like Kerry did to send missionaries out. Well, the agreed. In 1810, they formed the American Board of Commissioners for Foreign Missions. Now, again, it was supported not just by Congregationalists, but by others as well that shared their interest, but the ones they sent were congregational missionaries. About 10 went in the first group, and among them were Adoniram Judson, Ann Judson, and Luther Rice. Now, Luther Rice, interesting guy. He had been engaged, but when his fiancée heard, "You're going where?" "Not with me," she broke off the engagement, and to his credit, Luther Rice did not back down. He said, "Well, I'll go as a single individual." And to this day, one drawback for many people to missions is the prospect of going there single. Either a boyfriend or girlfriend does not agree with you, and quite often folks are turned away for that reason. Well, Luther Rice went along with this couple, Adoniram and Ann Judson. Now, they were going to be going to Burma, but they planned to stop first in India. And they would have the chance to meet Carey, the famous pioneer there. And they said, "Well, you know, Carey's a Baptist, and we're congregational. And we're going to study up on baptism to be ready to debate with him." And to their surprise, as they began to study their Greek New Testament, they found, to their chagrin, that Carey was right, and they were wrong. Now, the first was Adoniram, and then Ann said, "Well, you're crazy. Give me that Bible. I'll study it." And she too was convinced, and their friend Luther Rice was convinced. When they got three Baptists among a bunch of Congregationalists. They realized, well, it's not really right for us to take support from Congregationalists. We don't agree with their theology. And so they decided to send Luther Rice back and to raise support among Baptists to support the Judsons and himself. And so they went on to Burma to have a very, very adventurous life there. Adoniram was in prison for a while, was kept alive by his wife sneaking food into him in prison, writing letters back. Well, Luther Rice came back and began to travel up and down the eastern seaboard trying to rally Baptists for the cause of missions. He found that there was already a number of local societies, even some state associations began to move in that direction. And we'll say, well, why can't we link all of these up and from a national organization? Well, by 1814, only 4 years after he had come back, and they did create the General Missionary Convention of the Baptist Denomination in the United States of America, another very mouthful of them, called the Triennial Convention because it met once every 3 years. So, Triennial Convention, it began there, and their purpose was to support the cause of fund Luther, Adoniram Judson, Ann Judson. By the way, Luther Rice, he was such a good fundraiser, he was kept here raising funds for other issues as well, including a Baptist college. Never went back overseas, but did at least have a part in founding that organization there. Now, it's called a convention, but for the first few, it functioned as a society. Well, you know, what's the difference? Well, a very important difference that kind of shaped the future of Baptists in North America. Convention versus, a convention has the idea that churches should work together. Not just interested individuals, but churches. They say God desires to work through churches. They should associate with each other and work cooperatively to fund all the different things that churches should do. Not just foreign missions, but national missions, and education, and literature. They want to do all those things. Now, they began in 1814 with only having the one cause of foreign missions. But they were moving in developing other things. So a convention has a more of a centralized organization, churches working together to do a variety of tasks. Now, it requires a cooperative, trusting attitude. Because one church may say, well, you know, I love foreign missions. I'm not that thrilled about education. Or we think literature is important, but why send folks overseas? So you've got to say, if we're going to do all these things together as churches, it requires a strong cooperative understanding. Now, that's convention. Society is more single-focused. We're going to do this. And we're going to support this person to do this ministry. Very much any individual or church can be involved because you're only going to do one thing. And therefore, if you're committed and interested, you can know exactly where your money is going. They're going to support this person. This is the example, for example, of Wycliffe Bible Translators. We support Jim and Carol Dowson. A couple we know. We give our money earmarked for them. And that's how most groups do it. Campus Crusade, InterVarsity. You support that particular person. You know you're giving it for them. It goes very directly to, so you know exactly what you're giving for. If you want, in terms of being very focused, direct in your giving, well, that's a good way to do it. Now, for the missionary, let's travel around. Beat the bushes, go out there, raise their support. It's called deputation. And today, it takes about 2.5 years for the average missionary under this type of organization to rattle loose to all their relatives, visit all the churches they have connections with, go anywhere that someone will listen to them, and raise their support. Well, that's the society. Now, so with that idea, you have one society for missions, one society for education, one society for literature. Well, it's an awful lot of duplication of efforts there. And so convention, more centralized, but requires more cooperation. Society, more direct, more focused, but not as comprehensive. Under the one, you have the advantage that you can put all the resources of churches together, there's some helpfulness there in having a larger body of people to work with. It also doesn't require someone to be a skilled fundraiser. Yeah, you may be a very, very good missionary, but a lousy fundraiser. If you're a lousy fundraiser, you may never get overseas because it depends upon you to go out there and raise your support. So it allows for more centralized budgeting and planning. But the downside, it can allow for more dissatisfaction. If you're giving money for four different things and you're not supportive of all four things, well, there's the potential there for dissatisfaction. Well, we began calling this a convention. It began with only one cause. They had very limited funds. So their first focus was missions. But as the meetings went by, 1817, 1820, 1823, and they began to develop more things. They had the idea of also sponsoring a local Baptist college. Luther Rush was, again, the fundraiser for that. They began raising money, had pledges, bought some land in Washington, D.C. They also sent out their first home missionary, another former Congregationalist turned Baptist, named John Mason Peck. He went to the Midwest. And so they were moving in a variety of directions there, becoming more generally a convention. And again, it was supported by churches north and south. They sent their messengers. They determined priorities and things like that. And they were moving toward becoming a multiple function convention. Well, all along, Northerners had not been very pleased with this. They were more society favoring, and they made their move in 1826. In 1826, the meeting that year, that triennial meeting, the Northern, can we move this from D.C. To New York City? Well, okay, we guess so. And then, because it was there, they packed it with delegates from New York State and Massachusetts, and they let's cut out everything except foreign missions. Well, those in the South, they liked the idea of a college and national missions. And they felt they had been had. You move the missionary meeting further north, you pack it with those that favor your ideas, and we're caught napping, and we're voted down. Now, another reason why they did it then, in 1825, Richard Furman died. Furman had been the president of this convention the first 6 years, the most revered figure among Baptists north and south. And he was very strongly a convention man. But now he's no longer on the scene, so that they pull this political maneuver. They vote out everything except foreign missions. They leave John Mason Peck out there high and dry. Well, he raised his own support and kept on going there. They had a college. Well, Luther Rice had moved too far too fast with pledges. Those pledges didn't come in, and they lost their shirt on their investment in Washington. It's the George Washington University. It could have been Baptist had we been wiser, more foresighted there. This was the beginning of a division between North and South. North favored society all along. South favored convention. Now, why would this be? I don't know. And there are two things that seem possible. One was, think about the society of the South. And they were used to plantations, which were large, centralized operations. A plantation did farming and made their own clothing and their own furniture and almost everything. So it was a centralized operation. In the North, they were very decentralized. And they were doing their own thing individually, things like that. Also, in terms of theologically, in the South, there was a strong emphasis on churches working together. The importance of associations, the value of associations. In the North, especially the Northeast, they were very leery of churches being ruled by something bigger than the church. They had been in congregational churches where the local church was subordinate to the larger group, and they were very strong on local church autonomy. And so they liked having everything individual focus, single focus. Well, this is what happened in 1826. And for a while after, Baptists felt they had been betrayed, fooled, tricked. And there was some distrust sown there. But the next 20 years saw that distrust grow deeper over another issue, and that's slavery. And that leads to the formation of the Southern Baptist Convention. And we must be frank and say at the outset that the major issue that caused Southern Baptists to separate from their northern brothers and sisters was the issue of slavery. It was, of course, the hot issue across the country. And not only Baptists, but Methodists and Presbyterians, they also split around this time. And the Triennial Convention, they tried to remain neutral. They say we will neither support nor reject slavery. But that was not good enough for the Southerners. That they said, well, we have a man here. We're naming as a potential missionary. He has been a slave owner. Will you accept him as a potential missionary? And they were trying to force them to declare in favor that they were in support of slavery. By that time, again, there was enough folks in the northern that said, no, we can't say that slavery is a good thing, that we support it. That they tried to be neutral. We'll neither accept nor reject his nomination as a missionary. Well, to not act is to not accept it. So they took offense at that. They said, you're disrespecting our peculiar institution. And so in 1845, almost 300 delegates met in Augusta, Georgia, and their meeting there was to plan their response to this idea that their convention would no longer send out slave-owning missionaries as missionaries from the convention. And they met. It was almost a foregone conclusion. They would leave, and they did, and they voted then to form the Southern Baptist Convention. And it was a convention, and we'll move on more on that in a second, but they separated, and it's interesting, in 1995, at the 150th anniversary, the SBC published and passed a resolution condemning their origin in racism and their support of racism for decades upon decades, even continuing to this day in some areas of the South. And there are still some seminary students who will graduate and go into churches and naively invite people of color into their church and find out that there's still some racist in those. Well, we were born in racism. This may be a problem for us. But again, God can even bring something good of something with an evil beginning like that. And that was the origin of the Southern Baptist Convention. Again, 1845, Augusta, Georgia, more than 4,000 churches represented by about 300 messengers. Again, some were representing associations, larger groups. Well, they got together, and there was one man there from South Carolina, William Blaine Johnson, who came there with a draft of a possible constitution in his vest pocket. In case we vote to do this, I got an idea about how we could order. He had been a member of the Constitution Convention for the Triennial Convention, for the South Carolina State Convention, and now for a national convention. So he had the idea there, and basically he had this idea of a convention that at their triennial, they began triennial again, and then moved to 2 years, and then every year. And they say they will elect what they call boards of managers, and they will operate the various ministries the convention decides to support. And again, they deal along the way, but there was always a division. It would be more than a single-focused society, a multi-focused convention. And the members are not individuals, but churches. It's a convention of churches, not a convention of individuals. So we're working on a church basis, on a multiple ministry basis. And they would eventually choose four ministries that we still do to this day: international missions, North American missions, theological education, and the publication of literature. Those are the four major things that Southern Baptists do. Now, we today, in the 20th century, we began a Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission that works on First Amendment issues in Washington, D.C. and Nashville. But these were the four major. They get the lion's share of attention, funding, support, things like that. So I want to walk through the first 50 years now, from 1845 to the close of the century there, and lay out the early of these four different ministries, and perhaps a few details about different ones of them. First of all, international missions. Again, initially the Foreign Mission Board, fused to the International Mission Board, more politically correct term. It began 1845, and again, this was the focal point for the first year. This was the most important thing. This still was the lion's share of funding. And the first three major fields were Brazil, Nigeria, and China. And again, when I was serving in Brazil, there was a bronze bust of Buck Bagby, the first missionary to Brazil, and all five of his children followed in his footsteps there. And so there was a kind of a family legacy of Bagbys in Brazil. Well, they served in Brazil 61 years, the longest tenure ever, and will not be broken because today missionaries retire. They didn't. They just stayed there till they died and were missionaries the entire time. Well, most important incident that I will track from the first 50 years happened in 1888 and involved a missionary in China named Charlotte Diggs Moon. I'm referring to those of you who are better, to Lottie Moon. Now, Lottie Moon was a very, very short, about 4'8", a fireball of a woman, very well educated, arrived in China with God's call upon her life, began to agitate, send more missionary, we need more people. And she got criticized for preaching to mixed gatherings of men and women. She said, well, send more men, I won't do it. Send more missionaries. And she had the idea that she got from hearing some Methodists talk about it. She wrote back to her friends in Virginia, let's take a week around Christmas to pray for missions and take an offering to support missions. Well, the Women's Missionary Union point. In 1880, they took that ball and ran with it. The first offering they took up that year sent three additional missionaries to China. Alongside it. Well, Lottieman continued there to 1912. In that year, after serving there for decades, there was a famine in China, and she kept giving her food away to her Chinese friends who were starving, to where she came down ill of malnutrition. Finally, her friends, seeing her emaciated body, said, "Let's get her out of here and get her someplace where she can be healthy." She died on her way back to the U.S. in Kobe, Japan, in harbor there. But they brought her body back. It's buried in Virginia to this day. And 6 years later, after her death, they named the offering in her honor, the Lottie Moon Christmas Offering for Foreign Mission. And to this day, the Lottie Moon Offering is, for many folks, the highlight of their Christmas season, because every single penny goes to overseas missions. It is by far the largest missions offering in the world. It's the largest single source of income for the International Mission Board. Well, this was her legacy. Well, that offering began then to support missions. And by the end of 1900, we had 94 missionaries in seven different fields. Despite the disruption of the Civil War, poverty in the South, that kept growing. And that was one of the major missionary ministries of the SBC missions, international missions. Okay. Second thing, what about national missions? Well, they formed the Home Mission Board, and now the North American Mission. It had a more difficult beginning. For a number of reasons, they said, well, we have local associations and state conventions. Who needs a national organization? And if there is one, neither one, we have the American Baptist Home Mission Society. Yeah, and that was formed by that triennial convention. They formed a separate society for home missions. And there were still one-third of their missionaries in the South even after the Civil War. So who needs our own home mission board? Well, it struggled for a while until one thing caused it to survive. Sectional pride. We have Northern Baptist doing mission work in the South. Yeah, Yankee go home. We'll take care of that ourselves, if you please. And so what finally got the home mission board started was the desire to send Northern missionaries back home and do all the work in the South ourselves. Well, that gave them at least something of a start. But even to this day, the North American Mission Board has had a less clear rationale when their state associates, state conventions, local associations, especially when they made an agreement in 1894 with Northern Bay, you work north of the Mason-Dixon line, we'll work south. They had that kind of informal agreement. Well, if we're only doing things in the South, and there's state conventions here already, what is the reason for being for a home mission board? Well, they struggled for a while. Now, in the 20th century, we'll see that they turned a different tack. They begin to disregard that Mason-Dixon line border. Begins to say, we can work anywhere. Well, that gave the Home Mission Board more of a reason for being. But it has struggled even to this day. We'll talk more about that next week, the struggles of the Home Mission Board. Well, but they did begin that. And but it was operating by 1900. And so we have international missions, home missions. How about literature? Well, the Baptist Sunday School Board, today Lifeway Christian Resources, this was the last to develop. And in fact, there were four failed attempts before they got one that lasted. Now, two of them were crushed by the Civil War. In the Civil War, there was no paper to print literature. There was no machinery to operate the printing presses. All that was machinery was used for the war effort. Paper, that was all for the war effort, and so they had to close down. They closed because of the Civil War. There were two others that began but failed because of divisions within Baptists. There were Landmark Baptists and Non-Landmark Baptists, and they each wanted their own literature. So they couldn't agree upon any one press
that everyone would use. And so they went back and forth until 1890. And finally, J.M. Frost, a Richmond executive there, he was praying about this. He woke up in the night with a dream of how it could actually happen. He brought that to the convention, and there was the beginning of a debate there. But they did the Baptist thing. They appointed a committee. Could we actually form our own publication board? Well, in the committee, there were two strong personalities, J.M. Frost in support of it, and J.B. Gambrill in against it. Well, they finally said, well, we'll put you two in a room and let you write the report, okay? And then Gambrill said, well, you can write to Frost. Well, Gambrill said, Frost, you can write the report except for the last paragraph. I write that. So, okay, except for the last sentence. Well, I'll write, okay? And so Frost, this is a great possibility. We need this to unify us, to have our own literature. Gambrill said, but no one should be forced to use this. They can make their own choices of literature they want to use. And then last, but at least don't obstruct us. Okay? And so they agreed finally to pass it. And Lifeway soon it began to get support among Southern Baptists across the board, and play an incredibly important role in creating Southern Baptist identity. We're all on the same page. When I was growing up back in the 50s and the 60s, when I went to visit my grandmother, they were using the same squirtly that we were using in our church. Yeah. It was standing across the board. It was able to support our own programs, our own denominational emphases and things like that. And perhaps more important than we realize, in giving us a denominational identity, loyalty, things like that. Well, Lifeway. Today, they are the largest publisher of religious literature in the world, I think. They have their own zip code in Nashville, and the operation there is incredibly huge in terms of the amount of stuff that they churn out, things like that. Well, so we have international missions, national missions, literature, fourth ministry. Near and dear to my own heart is, of course, theological education. Okay? Now, again, this was, again, something of a question mark for a while, because in the 1830s, there was a blizzard of college building across the South. Richmond, Wake Forest, Furman, Mercer, Samford, Mississippi College, Baylor, every state had their own Baptist college. So some said, why do we need seminaries? We got our colleges, things like that. And there was also some distrust that Sandy Creek tradition, always suspicious of education at all. Okay? And so they weren't that enthusiastic. Finally, it took two states, South Carolina and Georgia. Remember that Charleston tradition that always supported education? Well, those two states said, we will give the theology of Furman University in Greenville, South, named after Richard Furman, a Baptist pastor. We'll give that department plus $100,000 toward founding a seminary if someone else will match us. Well, that was the beginning of Southern Baptist Theological Seminary in Greenville. It opened in 1859, had four faculty and 26 students. What a teacher-professor ratio there. Yeah? Four professors. In 26, J.P. Boyce, John Broadus, Basil Manley Jr., and William Williams, they met there in South Carolina. Boyce was the first president of that seminary, and he had been thinking about what a seminary should be like for Southern Baptist for quite a while. In fact, there was a custom at Furman University when you began your tenure as a theology professor, you would give an inaugural address. Well, Boyce had been hired on the faculty there as a theology professor. He had given, this is in 1856, three aims of theological education for Baptists. He said, if we have a seminary, it should first of all be broadly accessible. We have lots of pastors who don't have college education. And therefore, there should be some way for our seminary to be of benefit to them. And so very accessible. That's why there was Boyce Bible College at Southern, why we have a college here, things like that. There was always a track within South, an associate program that would allow someone who did not have a college education, called to ministry perhaps in his 30s or 40s, to come back and get some theological education and make you, because again, early on especially, most of our pastors were not college educated. And to this day, our students have a very, very lenient admission policy. Yeah, not very hard to get in. If you have any college degree, you can pretty much get in. And then we'll let you kind of sink or swim after that. But yeah, we get money for how many students we admit and how many we turn away. So lenient admissions policy, no college degree, we still have programs for you. Okay? Because again, we want to be broadly beneficial. And so on the one hand, that accessibility, well, we recognize our clientele, our convention. And so we have to have education where it can be accessible to a wide variety of people. But alongside that, the second thing that Boy said, we also need an academically rigorous track because we need to produce our own professors. We don't want these guys going off to Germany and coming back with these liberal ideas and things like that. So we need to be able to give the very much rigorous training to have students who are able to make our case in the marketplace of ideas, produce our own theology. Now, those two aims exist in some tension. And so in a classroom where I have a wide variety of students, from some that come from a community college, and some come from a university, how do I teach in a way that's accessible to all, yet prepare some for going on to more rigorous study? This is the challenge we face every day in our classroom. Well, it's part of our own reason for being. Yeah. We want to be broadly accessible, to support our dynamic broadly, and yet at the same time prepare some who can go on and produce literature, theology books, market professors, those types. Well, those are two ideas. Third aim, see, we must have a doctrinal anchor. Now, he had seen that some people tend to go left. He said the seminary must have a doctrinal anchor, a statement of faith, that will be affirmed by all who teach there to make sure they only teach the theology that we affirm and we support. And so that was the Abstract of Principles, 1859, written by Basil Manley Jr., a lawyer. This is still the one of the statements of faith that we affirm at Southeastern, along with the most recent, the Baptist Faith and Message 2000. Well, both those things are serving to anchor the seminary. Well, this is how they began then with four faculty, 26 students. Two moments I want to call to your attention from the first 50 years of our history. The first happened after the Civil War. Most of the faculty had been serving as chaplains in the forces of the Confederacy. And now, in 1865, the war's over. The seminary had closed for the war. Now they're saying, can we reopen? It will be difficult. Very little money in the South, many discouraging ideas out there. The four faculty met, and one reportedly, John Broadus, said, let us agree that the seminary may die, but that we will die first. Yeah. So that they reopened the student 18 with seven students now. Yeah. And to make payroll with seven students, J.P. Boyce is the key figure. He came from a very wealthy Charleston family. He could have been the president of banks, railroads, very sharp, able man. He began to use his own money to do the payroll. He began to travel ceaselessly all over the South. With any church, anybody that would listen, he said, I beg for money for my seminary like I wouldn't beg for my family. I'm totally shameless, he said. I will do it to keep the seminary alive. Well, finally, that they almost put it up for auction. Anybody that will give us some endowment will move there. This is 18. They moved from Greenville, South Carolina, to Louisville because Louisville offered them some money, some buildings, some grounds, some cash. We'll go there. And they've been there ever since. Well, eventually, they began to turn the corner. Things began to get better. And they were even able to add a fifth faculty. To the original four, they added a man, Crawford H. Toy. A very interesting man. He was a protege of John Broadus, a very sharp man. He had twice been engaged to Lottie Moon. She broke it off both times. Second time, we have a copy, her copy, of some work that Toy had been working on that she read and had questions about his theology. He was an ultimate professor, an electrifying lecturer, fascinating intellect, things like that. But he had visited Germany and begun to drink in German criticism of the Old Testament. Began teaching that in his classes. And Boyce and this said, now listen, this does not match the abstract that you signed to teach in accordance with and not contrary to. Now, Toy never thought that he had gone beyond the bounds. It's interesting how elastic some words can become when you want them to be. So he began to say that it's a very elastic document, but no, you're not there. You've moved from where you were when we hired you, and find that they did require him to resign. He did. He left. Left and went to teach at Harvard. No slouch. He also became a Unitarian. They saw his theology was going in a very, very bad direction. The great thing is a statement by Boyce. They went to see Toy off at the railroad station in Louisville. And Boyce said, I would give my right arm to have you where you were 10 years ago and have you remain there. So this was not something they said in anger. This was deep grief and sadness. But they said, we have to do this to be honest, be faithful to our task, which is to take the money of Baptists and prepare Baptist pastors, Baptist ministers. And it would be unethical for us to take their money and not support their views. Well, I commend both the attitude and the attitude of sadness, regret. This was someone they loved. He had been their colleague. But secondly, the action, taking the action necessary to address a problem they saw. Now, Toy never thought he was in a problem, but they saw that and they began to address it. Now, in the years to come, that cure would be relaxed. It will lead to problems in the 20th century, but we'll come back there next week and just what happened then. But then this is the first four major international missions, home missions, literature, education. Those are the things that the SBC began with and continue with to this day. Let me pause and take any questions from you.